Logan, we had your mom's favorite Bitcoiner on the show today, Tur Demeester. It was a hell of an episode. I think you guys are going to love it. This was brought to you by our good friends at River. The price of Bitcoin is going up, predominantly because of the ETFs, people think. Don't buy the ETF, buy actual Bitcoin. River makes it extremely easy. You can DCA into Bitcoin and pay no fees on those buys. You can set limit orders if the price is very volatile. You think it's going to fall or go up and you want to buy at a certain price. You can set those orders at those prices. River builds their own infrastructure. They don't depend on trusted third parties. They're focused on Bitcoin, so they're able to actually build a good product, unlike some of their competitors, which can't handle the massive inflow of adoption that is headed our way. So go to River. They're the exchange that I trust. River.com/TFTC. Sign up today. You're going to get $5 worth of Bitcoin. This was also brought to you by our good friends at Unchained. Unchained is here to help you eliminate single points of failure in your custody model. You'll hear an example of this episode of how it saved one of my friends from losing their Bitcoin. Their vault product is a 2 or 3 multi-sig collaborative custody vault. You hold 2 keys. Unchained holds 1. You eliminate single points of failure. You get your Bitcoin off the exchange. You get in the multi-sig cold storage. It's going to save you. It saved my friend's ass. He got SIM swapped on Sunday. The hackers got his phone, got his email, went to go drain the exchange accounts that he used to use, and they got there, and there wasn't any Bitcoin there because my friend smartly moved his Bitcoin to an Unchained multi-sig collaborative custody vault. He had a very good Monday. I mean, it wasn't a very good Monday. He had to deal with getting SIM swapped, but his Bitcoin was safe, and that was because of Unchained. Go to unchained.com/consultation. Set up a call with them to learn about their vault product. They have an IRA product. They have a trading desk. They have a lending desk. Learn about all their products. They're doing it the right way to help you secure your Bitcoin. Bull market's here. Secure your Bitcoin properly so you can have peace of mind. Go to Unchained. Unchained.com/consultation. Tell them the TFTC sent you. This rip was also brought to you by good friends at Zaprite. You can buy Bitcoin or you can accumulate Bitcoin by offering your customers to be able to pay in Bitcoin. Zaprite makes this extremely easy. They've built an invoicing software that allows you to connect any wallet that you use. They're wallet agnostic. They are simply a software on top of your wallet information that issues invoices, payment links. They have a WooCommerce integration. They have fiat integrated as well, so you can invoice for fiat and Bitcoin in one spot. It's impeccably designed, great dashboards, great accounting. Now they just added teams too, so if you're an organization with more than one person, you have a bookkeeper, you have an accountant, and you want to get them on the Zaprite account, you can do that now. They just initiated their teams feature. If you're a doctor, a lawyer, a rancher, a podcaster, and you want to begin accumulating Bitcoin, the best way to do that is to sell your services for Bitcoin. Zaprite makes that extremely easy. Go to zaprite.com/TFTC. Sign up using the code TFTC for their annual plan, and you'll get $40 off that plan. So it's $240. With TFTC, you'll get $40 off, $200 for an annual subscription to Zaprite. Last but not least, this rip was brought to you by our good friends at Bitcoin Talent Co., a recruiting firm built by Bitcoiners for Bitcoiners. If you're a company in the space looking to hire as the bull market's going, your runway is extending because you have Bitcoin on your balance sheet, because you're a smart company, you're able to hire more people. Bitcoin Talent Co. is here to help you find those people, whether it's designers, finance, engineers. They're sufficient with Bitcoin mining as well. Andy, the co-founder, started Uber, built their team from 10 to over 1,000, or excuse me, from 100 to over 10,000. He knows what he's doing. He's a Bitcoiner. He understands Bitcoin. He's going to understand your needs as a company. They have a flex product too. Maybe you need part-time sprint work for 3 months, 6 months. You can tap into their flex bench, their roster. So go check it out. Go to bitcointalent.co. Tell them that TFTC sent you and enjoy this very bullish rip with our good friend, Tur Demeester.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, You probably should be.
Ter, it's good to have you back, sir.
Marty, good to be here.
It's
man, it's wild lately.
It has been. That's why I wanted to get you back on. I haven't prepped you for this at all.
Yeah, yeah.
But I have something to say. I've been following you on Twitter for what feels like the better part of a decade now. We met in person in 2018. So I've been following your analysis and your perspective on Bitcoin for some time now. And I don't think at any point in the time that I've been following you, I've ever seen you this bullish. You've gone full.
Yes.
You're fully bulled up right now.
Yes.
What is going on in your mind?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, yeah, it's, I think that looking back, because I think there was something that felt a bit off about the 2021 atmosphere rally. Like it was, and of course that's just one cycle ago, maybe, you know, I don't know, back in 2017, that was another cycle, but definitely the 2021, something felt off and like everyone was like high, right? I mean, like everything was going crazy in terms of prices, real estate, just equities, just everything, shit coins. And I think part of why I'm so bullish is that it's like the world is like, there's some sanity in the world again. Like there's some focus, like Bitcoin is going crazy. Not really. I mean, it's just the beginning, but I don't know. It's the way it should be, right? I mean, the finally investors after 14, 15 years are starting to understand that this thing is important. I don't know. I think additionally, I think Milei getting elected was like, it really, it killed something in me that was like, oh yeah, I guess, you know, as a libertarian, I'm always going to fight like the losing battle, or it's just, you know, I'll be the guy who's like in the corner, like, excuse me, like we could just maybe, you know, not have welfareism and subsidizing everything like crazy. Just to see that happen, it really gives me hope, because, you know, it's not that I don't want for people to get nice things. It's just that I want societies that are sustainable, economies that are sustainable, that can actually grow. And so, yeah, I feel a lot of hope. Yeah.
I do too. And it does feel like this time, I almost said it, this time is different in a way, because we have the ETFs are here, which I'd love to get your thoughts on, one of your broader thoughts on the ETFs. I think enough time has passed in Bitcoin's history and the history of its competitors, particularly altcoins, that it's becoming clear that there's a clear demarcation between Bitcoin and the rest of the crypto world. And on top of that, you have all these tailwinds that are blowing on Bitcoin's back, whether it be record low confidence in institutions across the board, whether it's media, politics, education, medicine, whatever it may be. People are really not happy with the state of the incumbent power structure. So they're more receptive to a disruptive technology like Bitcoin that could hand power back to the individual and society at large. And then on top of that, you have this very interesting dynamic at play from a monetary policy perspective, where the Fed has rates above 5%, and a narrative for a long time was Bitcoin essentially moves with Fed policy. If they're lowering rates of printing money, of course Bitcoin's going to go up, but the last 6 months have proven that Bitcoin is beginning to dislocate from that broader narrative.
So yeah, I want to throw this out there as a theory / prediction, and it might already be already happening. We used to be assuming, because Bitcoin was so small, that Bitcoin responds to things that happen in the world. And so that, you know, one of the things that, you know, we've talked about and many people talk about is that Bitcoin is actually correlated, the cycle is actually correlated to the money supply, right? I mean, Bitcoiners are smart. They look at the actual monetary inflation and then they respond to that by buying. But I think what's going to start happening is that the tail is going to start wagging the dog, meaning the world markets are going to start looking at Bitcoin as an advance indicator that something big is starting to happen, because Bitcoin is now $1 trillion. It's going to go to $10, $100 trillion. And so when the Bitcoin price rises up, because of, you know, the laws of physics, communicating vessels, it means somewhere else a bubble is deflating. Something is going on elsewhere. And so to look at the Bitcoin price can be like an early indicator that something big is happening. And so it just occurred to me a few days ago, I really think people are going to start looking at Bitcoin as an early indicator. And specifically what this could mean now is... money leaving the banking system, just going to be parked in Bitcoin where it cannot be confiscated, because banks really are totally underfunded. They have extremely low reserve rates, and they don't offer Bitcoin directly. So it's not like, oh, you can store your Bitcoin with us and then we can fractionally reserve it and, you know, do all kinds of things with it and still keep our business going. It's like, no, once you buy Bitcoin, even an ETF, like, it's actually leaving the bank. And so, yeah, I think that's something potentially really big that's happening.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And to put that thesis to the test for this particular price movement, like, what do you have any inclinations of what's currently deflating and flowing into Bitcoin specifically?
I mean, Peter Brent just tweeted out accurately. He says crude oil is breaking out, stock markets are breaking out, obviously Bitcoin is breaking out. And so if everything's breaking out to the upside, it basically means the denominator is starting to get really hurting, starting to hurt, and that's the dollar. So the dollar weakening, I think that's what everybody expects. You know, Biden wants to keep the market strong, but also inflation down. But at the same time, the you know, as we all know, the governments have to keep on somewhat staying solvent, and so they need income. 20% of their budget is already being spent on just paying interest rates, paying interest on their debt. So they're just going to have to print a lot more. The only question is when. When is the big next wave coming? And if you look at global M2, it's actually already trending up again. So we don't even have to wait for, you know, Powell or whoever to say, like, yes, you know, we're now officially lowering interest rates. Like, you know, central banks around the world are already doing it.
Mm-hmm. Mm. That was another interesting thing that happened this week, was Bukele at CPAC over the weekend, actually, last weekend, basically exposing the fraud of government debt.
I'm not sure I followed that. Yeah. What is the summary of that?
Basically went to CPAC and gave a 5-minute speech on the dynamics of monetary policy and government debts, and basically laid out for the audience at CPAC that your government is funded on debt and money printing, like, in tax collection is essentially a humiliation ritual to make you think like you are actually paying for things that the government does.
Right, right, right. It's like we're all citizens. That, you know, we're all underlings of this ICO, this like shit coin, and they can just print more whenever they want to. But to kind of keep up the charade, they're like, oh, well, we're actually also taxing you and you got to pay your taxes. But it's all just to keep up the idea that it's actually backed by anything, the currency.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, I think the bigger picture of that as well is that Bitcoin and economics, like sound economics, are actually becoming genuine political talking points. Like, I saw that meeting, you might have seen it too, between Vivek Ramaswamy and Milei. And the first thing they said was like, I think Vivek said like, hey, I'm more of a Hayek guy, you're a Mises guy, like, we're all friends here. And then, of course, Milei said like, oh yeah, but, you know, Rothbard is superior to all of them. And anyway, he didn't say that exactly, but just the fact that, like, you know, Austrian economics, just sound economics, it's starting to resonate with people that, like, hey, something's going on here. Like, we want to know, and you can't just keep telling us that inflation is like the weather and that, like, we just have to look at consumer spending to somehow predict it. Like, no, 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 it's created by money printing. Like, regular people are starting to catch on to that.
Yeah, and there's... like a bunch of things in the sound economics movement. I really like calling it sound economics. It should just be economics, plainly. We shouldn't have to label it as Austrian economics. It just should be
non-garbage economics.
Yes. But trends over the last year, like E.J. Antoni has been making the rounds on Fox News and CNBC and getting out there. He's from the Heritage Foundation, doing a good job of explaining sound economics. Peter St. Ange, I think his daily videos that have, every single one of them seems to go viral, hundreds of thousands, millions of views, doing a good job of getting good education shows like this, a bunch of other Bitcoin shows, I think people are really, and again, like you said, Malay getting elected is really an inflection point of people are waking up to the fact that the economic systems they've lived within their whole lives are potentially systemically broken.
Yeah, and we've all experienced as Bitcoiners that one of the best, absolute best ways to orange pill someone is just to explain the problems with the existing system. And that's, you know, that's what the Saifedean's Bitcoin Standard does, what so many Bitcoin books are doing. And so it's kind of like, it's lifting the veil from people's eyes. And I think the reason why the time is now is that now there's actually something you can do about it. And like, it used to be this kind of shoulder shrug moment. It's like, yeah, everything is kind of fucked up. Like, you know, we know that, but you know, we just move on. There's nothing we can do. Whereas now it's like, no, you can opt out. Like, just get some Bitcoin.
Yeah. Mm. That's the big question.
And well, you could have done that the last 10 years, but now there's the relief, the psychological relief that there is, like, you know, really high profile people that are leading the charge and that are like giving a good example. There's all kinds of, like, you know, different political colors involved with this movement. And I think that's changing. Like, and also the access is easier. You don't have to like jump through the KYC hoops anymore. You just buy the ETF or something. Your advisor is finally starting to talk about it.
Yeah, let's
so dig the taboo more is starting to reduce.
Like, how big in your mind are the ETFs?
It's humongous. And it's kind of boggles my mind that, you know, 7 months ago when we talked, we were talking about my report, which is like, you know, how to position for the Bitcoin boom. And it doesn't even mention ETF approval as a factor. I was just like super bullish and like all these tailwinds for Bitcoin. I didn't even, and I'm kind of, in a way, I'm glad I didn't. It shows how jaded we all were, and I was after 9 years of like all this regulatory fight to get it approved, that it was ever going to be approved. But I think it's important that we actually have a genuine bullish case for Bitcoin, regardless of ETF approvals. I do think this is, somebody said on Twitter, like, this is the equivalent of, I think it was David Bailey, the equivalent of the whole world getting approved to their Coinbase account. Like, all of a sudden, the whole world literally has direct access to Bitcoin, at least the Western world, who has a brokerage account. And yeah, I mean, the amount of money going in is insane, right? And it's going to be, of course, there's going to be, you know, it's kind of like the 15-year-old who's starting to drive with a car. Like, yeah, he's going to wreck the car at some point, or some of the teenagers are. And so some of these ETFs are not going to be the place to be. Like, and there's no, I mean, I'm sure we agree, like, no way these ETFs are all going to survive the next 30 years. Like, there's going to be some hacks. There's going to be, you know, but it's just growing pains. Like, it's part of the process that we are going to live through as, like, you know, we're kind of like the parents looking at the newbies getting into Bitcoin being like, yeah, like, people are going to make their own mistakes. And
that's cute.
It's cute.
No, it's funny because
so you think you're a Bitcoiner because you have some Bitcoin ETF shares. Yeah, that's cute.
Yeah. A couple of things here. Like, one, a bunch of people are like, the ETFs are here. Bitcoin's been co-opted. It's done. Wall Street's here. They're gonna control Bitcoin. I think Lynn Alden, I think she was on the Bitcoin Frontier podcast, and she basically flipped it. It was like, no, like, Bitcoin's an open source permissionless network. There's nobody, no Bitcoin committee that gets together and says, all right, we're gonna let ETFs in. Like, if ETFs want to form around this asset, there's nothing we can do to stop it, and you should just view the ETFs as an API for the incumbent financial world to plug into Bitcoin in some way or another.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And there's so much Bitcoin that is locked in, that the OTC desks don't have access to. And so the price is going to keep going up until we find some people wanting to let go of their Bitcoin. But yeah, I mean,
how crazy do you think it can get?
Do you think ETFs could, you know, could like custody more than 1 million Bitcoin, or 2 million maybe?
Where are they at? They're 370, or if you include GBTC, they're well above 700,000 already, right?
Yeah. I mean,
so they're not too far.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that we have to keep an eye on. You know, at when Mt. Gox went bust, it had 7% of all Bitcoin in circulation, which is a nice precedent. You know, Mt. Gox never had any power over Bitcoin.
And most of these ETFs are using Coinbase as a custodian, which just this week had another
Yep. Embarrassing moment.
Embarrassing moment where they can't seem to handle high price volatility. Their systems.
Also, simple things like the retail people, they literally saw zero balances appear instead of like an error message that, hey, like we're unable to lower your, to reveal your balance right now. Don't worry, your coins are safe. Like that's like 101 stuff. And they had like 3-year bear market to prepare for an increase in volume. It's just, you know, it's like, I'm always like a bit self-conscious when I criticize Coinbase because I'm kind of like, you know, well, would I do a better job? And it's like, but at the same time, like you have to think about some objective industry standards. Like we are growing up now, companies need to, and there's other companies that show how it can be done. Like these are not impossible standards to not shit the bed the moment like Bitcoin has a surge of interest, which was totally expected.
Yeah.
Maybe do a little less shit coining, like maybe focus, get a bit more involved in the engineering world. Like, cause that's for a long time. Like, you know, there are certain Bitcoin companies that don't have that good of a reputation. If you actually talk to the engineers who are a bit more insular, you know, and then the ones that do focus on pushing forward open standards, getting involved in the conferences. Those are the ones that kind of hold themselves to the universal standard that we, you know, naturally Bitcoin holds itself to.
Yeah. And you'd think like Coinbase went through this problem in 2017, same exact thing. And then Brian Armstrong comes out and like, we load tested this for a 10x increase in volume, and the volume far surpassed our expectations. And it's like, dude, we just, like you said, went through a 3-year bear market. Like, of course, when the interest comes back, it's probably going to be 10x above what your standard rate was during that period of time.
I'm afraid it's a bit of an attitude problem, because like I felt like he was defensive in his tweet. He was like, oh, but you know, we tested for 10x volume increase and this, you know, exceeded that, kind of like trying to say like there was no way that we could have predicted this, like this is like an act of God or something. And like, no, like take responsibility. I just say like, hey, this is not cool, like, you know, I'm gonna get to the bottom of this. Or so that attitude, it's like, it's not about this one time. It's just like, I think it's a pattern, you know, and I think it's going to cause them to lose the lead. You know, they're going to lose their lead in Bitcoin.
Yeah. And they have a pretty massive lead right now. And imagine being an ETF provider, or not even an ETF provider. Somebody bought one of the ETFs that these providers are distributing to the market, and you know that Coinbase is the custodian, and then you see this problem and you're thinking, oh, yeah, the shares that I just bought in this ETF, the Bitcoin underlying it is held by this company. Like, I'm not comfortable with that.
How many thousands of emails did customers send to, like, imagine you're like, you bought like a $15 million chunk, you're some kind of fund, and then you notice that the custodian is embarrassing themselves like this. Like, I would email my ETF manager and be like, what's going on? Like, can you guys switch?
No, and then it highlights the centralization risk. And I tweeted this yesterday. I think you liked the tweet. Like, these ETFs, if they're going to be responsible and proper fiduciaries, they should custody this Bitcoin in multi-institution, multi-sig, where you don't have a single, like, obvious failure.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, it's embarrassing how little insurance there really is. I think Coinbase is only insured for like $400 million.
I think it's like 1% of their hot wallets. Not
oh
even.
Oh my God. It's like, and so that means that this ETF, of all the ETFs that exist in the world, which is probably thousands, is probably the single most high-risk ETF that you can own, where you have genuine risk, realistically, in the next 5 or 10 years to get wiped out. Because people think an ETF is like golden, right? Somehow. But like, the Fed is not going to bail out Bitwise if they all of a sudden get hacked or Coinbase gets hacked.
No.
No. So, and it'll be, so that's kind of what I think is the likely next phase, is like, you know, this is going to be a bad event that happens somewhere during this bull cycle. And then the Fed is going to be like the cavalry coming in, or the regulators, and they're going to be like, hey, we need more regulation, you know, even though if we like turn back the clock and look at what happened, it's like, no, it's because you guys pretended to give this one seal of approval, or like pretended to do your due diligence and then give only one company your seal of approval that this could happen in the first place. But never mind that, they're going to come in and say, hey, you know, we need more regulation. And then I think they're going to start pushing for a Federal Reserve of Bitcoin. Like, it's weird to say it, right? But it, that seems the logical next step, that they're going to be like, you know, we need kind of a fund that is more thoroughly protected so that when these custodians go bankrupt, we can then provide relief to the people that have lost money and at least, you know, give them a smaller haircut or blah, blah, blah. It's just all the usual stuff we know from the 1910s here in the U.S. Like, I don't know. It feels a bit like overly simplistic. Like, maybe there's going to be other ways that they're going to want to intervene that I'm not seeing. But yeah, so that's another reason, I think, why you want to keep your money out of these regulatory darlings, custodians, because you have that like split in the market where there's pure market players that are just kind of like, yeah, regulation is just a pain in the ass. Like, we're just going to get what we need in terms of licenses, but we focus on serving our customer and having top-notch security. And then another part of the market that's like, we're all about compliance, compliance, compliance. We want to become the darlings of the federal government and of, like, you know, the powers that be. And then what you're going to see is that technologically, these are going to be inferior companies, just like we see in the energy markets and other places. And so you want to be on the right side of that market. I mean, obviously, with Bitcoin, the nice thing is that you can obviously do your own custody and or involve a company into one of your multi-sig, signatures. So, but yeah, I think that's probably where we're going. We're like, we're going to kind of have this split in the market.
Mm. Yeah, and if you're listening out there and you're owning the ETF and you're thinking, oh, I feel comfortable here, like, you have to act early, because I have a microcosm example of this risk in my own life this week, where I have a buddy who's a public figure and he's talked about owning Bitcoin in the past, and a couple of years or 3 years ago now at this point, he had all of his Bitcoin on BlockFi and their yield generating product. And he told me that, and I was like, you need to get that out. Like, the way they're generating that yield is going to lose your Bitcoin. He did that, moved it back to an exchange. Like, a year later, he texted me. He was like, thank you. When BlockFi inevitably blew up, he's like, I got it out. I listened to you. Have it on the exchange. And I was like, you don't want it on the exchange. Like, connected him with the people down the hall and Unchained. I was like, set up a vault and secure your Bitcoin properly, because you are a public figure. You are a target. You've talked about owning Bitcoin. And lo and behold, this Sunday, he got SIM swapped. And they got control of his phone, his email.
Wow.
And they tried to get into all the exchange accounts that he was previously using and holding his Bitcoin on. But since he had his Bitcoin in a multi-sig collaborative custody vault with Unchained keys offline, they weren't able to get his Bitcoin. But it was only because I was telling a story similar to this at the time. He had his Bitcoin in BlockFi. BlockFi was seemingly fine. And they inevitably blew up. And then he had it on exchange. And I was like, that's a risk. If you get hacked, you're going to lose your Bitcoin.
Yep.
And it was fine at that moment. But he then moved to Unchained. And then, lo and behold, this week, he has a personal blow up where he has a security slip up on his end, and they tried to take his Bitcoin and they couldn't. So, moral of the story is, act earlier than later.
Yeah, and absolutely. And it's almost like, you know, it's almost like the human body, where like there's all these factors that are threatening our health and our livelihood, and but there's a silver lining, because the exposure to it builds your immune system. Like, you just learn every time, and hopefully, you know, you don't get, the attack is not too strong the first time around, so you can still, and that's where it can be a good idea, I think, to, if you're not into self-custody yet, to at least diversify your custodianship and things like that, to not have all your Bitcoin eggs in one basket. But yeah, just very, very interesting stuff. The world is learning so fast.
That's why another, yeah. It does feel like people are learning quickly, not only about Bitcoin, but about the corruption, systemic risks that exist in the incumbent system. And it does feel different. I don't know if it is different. It certainly feels different in many ways.
Yeah. And I feel like we can feel that there's going to be a changing of the guard in many, many countries. Like, because even just purely from a mathematical accountancy point of view, like, these kind of policies are unsustainable. Like, you cannot spend that much money going forward because the debt is chasing you down and like you're going to have to massively cut. I was actually looking at the, you know, I grew up in Belgium and so I obviously follow the news there still. And I remember just pulling up like a breakdown of the government budget and which is totally unsustainable. Like they also have 100% debt to GDP and things like that. And like some of the largest banks in Europe, which are zombie banks. And so I was like, you know, what would happen if Milei got elected in Belgium? Like, you know, what could you cut? And it pretty easily, like pretty obviously, you could cut like 80% of the budget, 80%, which means you could actually either lower taxes by 80% or, you know, start paying or like balance the budget at least. And very quickly, which we've seen in Argentina as well, in like 90 days, they had the first reversal of the deficit in like 12 years or 12 administrations, I think 12 years. So, but yeah, like, you know, and, but so in order to implement those ideas, you need new people. Like people are not going to believe the existing politicians that they, who created this problem that they can sort of figure, you know, they only know how to dig the debt hole deeper. Right. Yeah. And so, yeah, it's just becoming so obvious to me that, there's going to be a changing of the guards. And I think in some countries it's going to be great, and in other countries it's going to be kind of scary because it'll be kind of, you know, also people that don't get it but that just have a slightly different story and that are just going to try and keep digging, and we're going to, you know, have people get stuck. But at least I think there's going to be more of a diverse picture that is going to show up. And in some ways I think a lot of Bitcoiners are like looking around and kind of trying to understand which country is going where to decide, like, am I going to keep living here? I'm going to like try and get like residency in that country just as like a plan B. Or I definitely feel that there's more discussion about that. Definitely look in Europe, like it's just, it's one of the most precarious places. Yeah. Right, yeah. Now. Yeah. No, it really is. It really is because, you know, historically, there were some places that you could go to, like, you know, maybe like Switzerland or the UK, or like there was some, like the UK in a way was like the America of, you know, a couple hundred years ago. That's where people would go to. But like people are getting thrown in jail there for like just purely things that, just pure opinions, right? That are then labeled as racist or whatever it is, because they have all these hate crime laws. They're awful, right? They're throwing people in jail. They're fining them, and of course, there's zero self-defense. And so, if crime gets out of hand, like there's, you know, if there's going to be armed gangs and stuff, like people are just vulnerable, unable to help themselves. And you can also get sued for defending yourself, you know. So yeah, it is. You know, it's precarious. I think there's still going to be good places in Europe and or in that sphere. It's a big continent, and you have all that game theory stuff that starts playing on, because once as a country you start really being Bitcoin friendly, like you become like a magnet. And mm-hmm. then I think there is like it just strengthens, there's momentum that comes from that. And then of course there's a lot of money that's going to follow, so there's going to be economic incentives to keep it that way. So I don't know, maybe like an Iceland or there's so many, you know, things that are on the periphery that could really flourish. But yeah, it's not looking good in general. It's not looking good because of all the censorship, people can't even discuss the problems. It's so sad, right? You mm-hmm. can't even just like you and I sitting here, like I don't feel worried about, am I going to say the wrong thing? Like, can I get sued or thrown in jail? But like, it's so weird, you know? And growing up, I never had that feeling. But the last 10 years, it really started shifting that way, where I just honestly, I couldn't tweet the things I tweet, I don't think, or say the things I say on podcasts if I still lived in Belgium.
No. And Ireland's got crazy hate speech laws. You can't post memes without the police knocking on your door. Same in the UK. Canada.
Did you see the last thing? The proposal?
No.
It's insane.
In Canada, right?
Yeah, the Minister Life in Prison. Of Justice is backing this bill. It's a proposed bill. Indeed, throwing people in jail for life. For like this whole list of supposed hate crimes, which is like discriminating people or are talking badly about people based on age, physical appearance, religion, like basically the whole comedy scene. You could just like shut it down.
Like you say, okay, boomer, you're in the clinker for life.
It's just complete insanity. Oh my God. And so it again makes it so clear why this movement of Bitcoin is so important, because it's censorship resistant money. It means you can get the hell out. Mm-hmm. You know, like you can just, and it's like an insurance policy. You can just have it, stay living where you are with your family. If you decide like, look, we're all frogs here, this is getting a bit hot, I'm going to jump out, you can do it.
Yeah. And I think we need to better, not align ourselves, because I think we're already very aligned, but ally with movements like the one that happened in Argentina with Milei. Mm. Here in the United States, there's a big contingent of conservative thinkers and organizations like Heritage and obviously the Mises Institute. That there's a lot of people to understand that things are systemically broken, whether it's in the financial sector, the energy sector, the big pharma sector, and they grok that central planning is the core issue of all these sectors, and the government's meddling is leading to massive disruptions in the market and the quality of life for individuals. And yet many of them do not grok Bitcoin and understand that if they were to lean into it, an ally with the Bitcoin movement, mm-hmm. it would be extremely powerful.
Yeah, it's more than just a lifeboat, right? Because the lifeboat idea is like, oh, you know, you can kind of get away from the problem or survive a little bit. It's really like you have this society as a body, and then there's a big cancer who's like growing and really undermining the ability for the body to survive, which is that like welfare warfare complex that's fueled by fiat. And so Bitcoin really is a system that helps the body route energy around that and siphon energy away from the cancer to literally starve it and to diminish its influence and diminish its power, because the power ideologues and like these people think in terms of violence. It literally is how the system is wired, and that's why things are so precarious now, because if there wasn't Bitcoin, I would be a lot more worried. Not that I'm not worried now, but it's just like I would struggle so hard to find an alternative to World War III, right? But mm-hmm. like this idea of like, you know, literally defunding all these dangerous institutions and giving the money literally or allowing the economic energy to flow to people that are peaceful minded, that are long term oriented, that might withdraw for a while from the, you know, the chaos, and then once things start to settle down a bit, can come in and help, you know, reestablish institutions, retool things, build new institutions. That's giving me so much hope, you know, and the fact that it's the first time in history that this can happen where the wealth is not tied down geographically. And so it's just so powerful that you can have a family office or like a very large stash of wealth that is just hanging in the cloud where those violence oriented, I don't know, socialists, communists, whatever you want to call them, collectivists is probably a good word, where they cannot be reached, where they cannot reach that.
Yeah. And this is a conversation people have a lot in the Bitcoin space, is like, how long will it take to get to that point where we can, the dust is settled and we can come in and begin rebuilding institutions and reinvesting in a stronger economy? And I might be naive, maybe too optimistic, too idealist, whatever word you want to use, but I think the reflexive nature of the Bitcoin price expedites the process much.
Yeah, much it does. Which is why Bitcoin is going to be attacked. Like, we can predict it now, right? I mean, Bitcoin is going to be blamed for the inflation, because people are going to say, you know, the powers that be are going to be like, this is wrong. Like, you know, you guys are getting everyone to invest in your pyramid scheme, therefore we have so much inflation. It's your fault. And we're just going to have to kind of shrug and be like, well, good thing I'm out of Dodge, because, you know, I think you're wrong. I don't wish you any ill, but I don't want to be thrown in a cage for disagreeing with you. And so, yeah, I'm just going to wait until you're kind of tired, because, you know, you are now poor.
But even with that point, like, I think they're losing again, the public, like look at Elizabeth Warren, the Department of Energy, the EIA,
right.
This registry, they sent the miners, Riot, Texas Blockchain Council got on the horn right away.
Mm-hmm.
Basically like, no, you're not doing this. And now it seems like it's settled. I'm not sure exactly where it sits right now, but they initially got a temporary restraining order. They were supposed to have a case or a hearing on Wednesday that got canceled. It seems like there's a settlement outside of the court that happened, which doesn't seem like we have to answer the survey anymore. And we have all the data on our side, like in that particular argument where they're like, Bitcoin's dangerous to the grids. Mm-hmm. And you literally just pull up the data of ERCOT and the large flexible loads and you point to it and you're like, Bitcoin miners are 95% of the large flexible load in this grid, and you can visibly see when they turn off, when demand spikes, and you can visibly see the prices go down because they turn off.
Like, yeah.
Your arguments hold no weight.
Yeah. But I feel like I can almost speak from experience. Cause I grew up in Belgium, which has that culture of like, you know, you kind of bow your head, you like, you just kind of, you know, stay below the lawnmower. There's always a fear of like, there's a lot of pressure for people to be normal or whatever, to kind of just survive.
Polarize.
Like focuses on survival more than like, let's do the best you can do. Let's be ambitious. Let's, you know, like, let's speak your mind, which is understandable because of the history. And there is that like victim complex, which is unfortunate, but I think it's very real. And it's this idea that basically it's when you haven't processed trauma, you just recreate it, right? And so Belgium was invaded twice in a century, and horrible things happened. And different from the UK, where they actually had treatment centers for PTSD and stuff, there's extremely little of that in Belgium. So there's just that's why, you know, addiction is so prevalent and things like that. But I think if you haven't, and I do think people pass it on even like from generation to generation, that like victim mindset, if you haven't really come to terms with what happened, and then you just basically recreate it. And I think this is kind of what happened, where you project helplessness into other people and you think like, oh, we got to help them. And they've done that with immigrants. Like they've really like, oh, these people in all around the world who are suffering, like, oh, I recognize that, you know, we've been there. And I'm not saying it's wrong to empathize, you know, not at all. But like from that kind of almost, well, definitely immature standpoint, they've started massively subsidizing immigration, like really to the extent where people get the same monetary benefits as, you know, local citizens who've paid taxes for generations and those kind of things. Not that I'm in favor of even that kind of welfare, but that's another story. But so, yeah. And so what they've done, rather than having a system, which is a little bit more the way the US works, where it's like, sure, you can become an immigrant here, but you pay your own way. You figure it out how to do it on a voluntary basis. You find a way to add value economically, you find a job, etc. And so because of that victim mindset, Belgians started to subsidize immigrants, and they've literally attracted a different kind of people. I don't mean racially speaking. I just mean the type of person who would be attracted to welfare is a different type of person who would be attracted to here's an open market with very high mobility, where it's easy to climb the ladder of society if you just put in the work, right? That's different. And so now Belgium has lots and lots of immigrants that are being actively subsidized. I just saw a statistic where it says literally of all the countries in Europe, degree of employment in Belgium among immigrants is the lowest. It's 50%. So 50% not only does not work, but of the 50% that does work, a lot of them even work only part-time. And if you don't work, you don't have a job, you literally get unemployment benefits just like everybody else. So it's completely unsustainable. But it's that mindset, and I guess what I wanted to get at was when I started talking about this helplessness mindset, is that it comes with a sort of almost like a visceral set of what should I call it? Emotional impulses that regulate your behavior. Like you're basically kind of an unstable person, but you keep things going by viscerally responding to certain things in your environment. And so one of the things that I remember when I was like 18, in Belgium, there's a party called the Flemish Bloc, and mm-hmm. they actually, because of the anti-racism laws, they were sued, and they then just restarted the party with a different name. So, which is also kind of bizarre in itself. Like, you know, you get sued as a party because of, you know, things you've said. It sounds weird to me. But so this is a party that's long been for like more independence in Flanders, but they had a strong anti-immigrant standpoint. And for sure, I don't want to like whitewash it. Like there's people involved in there that are like definitely racist and, you know, like, but I think rather unfairly, they've been labeled as like extreme right, like literally like Nazis. And so they've been boycotted for like 20, 30 years now. And so when I was like 19 or something, or 20, something like that, or 18, a friend of mine said, like, just, we were just talking, and by the way, he said like, oh, that he had voted for this party. And I felt sick. I felt sick to my stomach. It just, the weirdest thing to now like look back on, mm-hmm. just because somebody voted for a party. And I looked at their program, and they're even like in favor, not that I would vote for them, but they're even in favor of like Swiss style democracy, where it's like, you know, you vote by referendum. It's, so there's like, it's definitely a mixed bag, right? I mean, now I wouldn't say like these guys are evil and all the rest are so much better. But because of my training, because in the mm-hmm. school system, and you know, everything is just, you get programmed to have a very visceral reaction against certain things. And so anyway, just long story, but that's what I think of when I see people like Elizabeth Warren just say the craziest things with a straight face, is that they seem like people to me that have been like, you know, really brought up in this like religion of victimhood, and that just are allergic to reason, are allergic to certain ideas. And so Bitcoin is just too much. It's too much responsibility. She assumes that she can't handle it. She assumes that her constituents can't handle it. And she feels like she needs to protect her flock. Mm-hmm. And that's my totally amateur analysis.
Everybody needs to go read their soul on victimhood. It is.
Soul? Thomas, Tao? Oh, yeah. Thomas, is that how you pronounce it? Thomas Soul?
Soul.
Yeah, yeah.
Known for correct pronunciation.
It's time I should learn my pronunciations as well.
No, I'm probably worse than you are, Ter. It's denigrate Logan.
I'm gonna try to get it right before he dies, at least.
No, it is. That's because it's such a all these issues we're talking about are so complex to solve, and that's why I anchor to Bitcoin. Because it's like, all right, if we're gonna solve all these problems, let's focus on one first, and an important one, which is money.
Yep.
Then, to your point, like rewiring people's brains to get out of the victimhood mentality is a daunting task.
Well, and you literally can't do it. Like literally when you like look into all the programs to help addicts and stuff like that, like the main thing is like, just like, you know, you kind of do your thing and let them do their thing, because the more you start to like, you know, treating them like their children, the more they get enabled, right? And the longer the dysfunction is going to last. Like you're feeding the cancer, right? And so it's kind of like, compassionately, you just have to kind of be like, I'm gonna buy my Bitcoin, you guys do your thing. But I feel like it helps me to, because they can get under your skin, right? It'd be like, oh, like, you know, what are you doing to us? And like, you know, and so it's like to deal with that, like to be like, oh, am I being an asshole, like by like, you know, just to promoting Bitcoin and not whatever, because that's often a thing, like, oh, you got to donate money and you got to like, it's like, actually, no, I think if we build this economy out, we focus on that. Like even Saylor, right? If he were to just be like, I'm not going to donate a single Bitcoin to a thing, I'm going to just burn all my private keys. he would be doing a boon to the world.
Yeah. Mm. He does want to go to the grave with his private keys. He said that.
I didn't know. I know he's talked about the possibility, but I didn't know he actually.
Oh, maybe the possibility.
Oh, okay.
Misquoting him. No, but it's. I'm so conflicted because I can see both sides. Because one thing at 10:31, we've been having a lot of calls with people, and one of the big themes across all the calls is recent Bitcoiners who were radicalized in 2020 and 2021. They had their eyes open to government overreach, money printing, found Bitcoin, eyes wide open. Holy crap, this is the solution. I just wonder how many others out there that we haven't spoken to, like what is the percentage of the overall population that had a somewhat radicalized experience?
And also like even the word, right? Radical, like we often like viscerally growing up, I would have been like, oh, you know, if you're radical, you're kind of scary.
If you get down to the definition of the word, it is like radically different perspective on the world. It's like radical change.
But right? But literally the Latin root is radis, which is root. So it just means you're going to the root. Mm-hmm. That's all, you know? And it's like it's weird, right? Once you just start thinking about it calmly, it's like, what does it actually mean to be radical? So like, yeah, I'm a radical. Yeah. You know, there's nothing wrong with that.
I'm going to get down to the root cause of what's going on and try to work from first principles.
Yep.
You have to get radical to think from first principles. But it is, again, too, like the language policing, even though we discussed all these hate speech laws that are coming in Europe and Canada, I do think people are throwing their hands up like, whoa, 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 whoa. Like, I think they're tired of the Orwellian.
Yeah.
Well, not only the propaganda, but the policing of individuals.
Exactly. And our context is actually, ironically, this is all happening in a context of, well, fittingly, understandably, this is all happening in a context of even growing connectivity. The world is more connected than ever before with Starlink and everything. Like you can literally live in the bush and have, you know, have internet. And now, you know, we're starting to get like peer-to-peer technologies that allows us to untether from more centralized internet providers. And additionally, the language barrier is finally being breached, right? Bridged with AI. You that literally, it's happening now. English. I was talking to a translator, DMing with him, asking like, so how is AI right now impacting your ability to translate? And I think he said the cost is down. I think it's like down 75%. So that means efficiency has increased by 4x. And he says most publishers haven't caught on to it, but actually a lot of translators for your first draft, you just like run it through an AI and you have a pretty good first draft and then you kind of like brush it up and stuff. So I think people who grew up in English don't realize like how poor the accessibility of information really is in almost any other language. Like maybe Spanish is a little different because it's such a big one. But like Dutch, I remember like, or I just know from growing up, the Dutch actually buy extreme amounts of books, like per capita, like one of the highest amounts in the world. They print lots and lots of books. And so having grown up in Flanders, we had access to that same market. It's the same language. But if you think about it, like if the ideas that are being disseminated via in the book market, let's say that we're looking at English language books, it's gonna follow a power law where you have a very, very long tail of just books that are less and less popular and that have more radical ideas, right? And the ones that are closest to the curve that are most popular are gonna be the cookbooks and the, like, you know, Hillary Clinton's memoir and stuff like that. So the ones that are being translated are all in that popular bracket. Like the more radical ones who are ahead of the curve, who are like kind of like the most novel science, don't get translated. So people are trapped in a language island very, very often. And it's not enough. Like you travel around Europe and you think like, oh, but these people speak English. It takes a level of proficiency to get comfortable with reading a book in English. Most people really don't do it. Like 90, I bet only maybe 1% of the population will, it's probably even maybe 1 in 1,000, I don't know. 1 in 100 maybe will read a book in English on a regular basis. And then because of they having grown up in that island, they have that bias. So they don't necessarily know to find the ideas that are going to juxtapose what they already believe. So anyway, so that's why I'm so optimistic for the coming generation, because instant translation, it's coming. It's here, it's almost here. Right?
I mean, did you see the Hey Gen video of Malay's speech, and it translated to English?
That
it sounded
too,
perfect.
Right? Yeah, yeah. That's, so, and we can even see them like lip synced and all in your local language. It's incredible.
Yeah, and there was a big Super Bowl commercial. I think it was Galaxy, one of the phone providers, ran this big spot where a gentleman lands in, I believe, Thailand or something, an American, and he gets an Uber, and he's voice messaging with the Uber driver, and he's speaking in English, and it's automatically translating it to Thai. Wow. And then the audio comes out in Thai.
Oh my God. Yeah, because I mean, in one of my first jobs was translating this giant book by Jesus Huerta de Soto about business cycles. It's like 500 pages, crazy amount of footnotes. Took me 9 months. 9 months. Every month I would like send in a chapter and they would pay me. I could like barely pay my rent and then like do the next chapter. And it was harrowing. And after that, I was like, I'm never doing this again. This is just crazy. I learned a lot. But I mean, like, that's the amount of work. Whereas now, like that same book, I don't know, an hour, you throw it in the AI and you have like a 80% version. You know, maybe I'm... because it's a technical book, so maybe it's only like 70 or 75%, but I mean, it's coming, right? It's just so exciting. All this Austrian economics, like that's been trapped, you know, in a way. It's, and of course, you know, the whole, the Bitcoin canon, like everything that's on Nakamoto Institute, like we can translate that to 100 languages in a snap.
Yeah. Now you got me all bullish and optimistic. It's like, imagine what the world would be like in a decade, 2 decades from now. The government's just got away, out of the way, allowed us to adopt Bitcoin, allowed us to lean into AI.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, and we run our own AIs locally, right? We don't have to abide by some...
We don't have to go get a license to
some
run
Google AI or something. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and then go on.
We don't have to go... I mean, it seems abundantly clear that the open AIs of the world, the Googles of the world, are actively petitioning to create regulatory moats and a licensing.
And they lie. They're trained to lie.
Yes. I mean, Google's Gemini product is laughably bad. That's the other thing, too, which makes me optimistic, is these people at high levels of the power structure, whether it's in politics or big tech or big media, they're just laughably shooting themselves in the foot. Like that Gemini release was like, are you kidding me?
Yeah, and I mean, on the one hand, you don't want to underestimate, you know, the ability that people in power have to, you know, go after individuals and things like that. But on the other hand, like, it's just so exciting to get involved in this burgeoning world economy. It's like Bitcoin. It's not even an island. It's like a continent. It's like a new continent. It's like, don't you want to live in the new world? It's like, how exciting is it? So like, so I think that there is a brain drain from people that prior were in Wall Street and government and like kind of just all meshed in with the powers that be. And now we have this like alternative, you know, it's like this new continent where you can, yeah, the casualty rate is pretty high still, but I mean, it's so exciting. And you just feel that it's like, this is where the next generations of people are going to create amazingly beautiful things.
Yeah. And it's already happening. Like, so for example, Lyle Pratt, from Vita Bitcoiner, what they're doing at Vita to combine AI and Bitcoin to reduce phone spam is pretty fascinating. Like we went through a demo of their product last week on a call, and what they're able to do for very little money is insane with AI.
So is it like with where you have to pay a little bit to call someone? Is it like
that? Yeah, so it actually acts as a screener. So
yeah.
Like if you're in my contact list, you don't have to pay me. But if you're not, you get screened by Vita, and then you reach an agent, my AI agent, which basically snuffs out, like, what's this call for? Are you spam?
Yeah.
Are you actually trying to get a hold of this person in a way in which they would want to respond? And then you can give the agent like, hey, I, if this, that, and the other thing happens, like, yeah, ping me, let me know. You should probably call them back. Or
so it's like your AI bodyguard.
Yes.
Damn.
But like, I mean, you can do really unique things with that.
It reminds me of...
And the cost is so cheap.
Wow. That reminds me of Jesse Powell back in 2015. He had this like little project called Elephant Grass, where I don't know if it was like very early, and he was basically just a little script where automatically whoever wanted to email him would get an email back and say like, well, you know, send some Bitcoin to this address, and then I'll respond. Like,
yeah, that's what 21 Code pivoted to eventually.
Oh, and so, but he said people hated him for it, and he just stopped doing it. But in a way, you could say like, well, you know, it just wasn't intelligent enough. This was like kind of like a mechanical bodyguard that was just, you know, too simplistic for the actual market demand.
Yeah, and you can think of it too. Like, there's instances where maybe it's not a spammer. Maybe it's a brand that's trying to get a hold of me. And
yeah,
if they want to pay me 1,000 sats for me to read basically a text message advertisement or respond to a survey to see if I'd be a likely customer, like, yeah, if you're going to give me 1,000 sats, yeah, I'll look at it. I'll read it. I'll interact.
Maybe you're worth a little more than 1,000 sats.
Yes. I don't know. The price going up, that could be a lot of money. And,
yeah, but that, that means your importance also goes up.
Quick break here, freaks. This rip is brought to you by Gradually Then Suddenly, a framework for understanding Bitcoin as money by Parker Lewis. I wrote the foreword to the book. I'm honored to have done so because it's the best 0-to-1 primer if you're looking for a logical explanation of why Bitcoin obsoletes all other money. Buy one for yourself and maybe a few for your friends. Go to thesafehouse.com/gradually. That's thesafehouse.com. Safe spelled SAIF, thesafehouse.com/gradually. Use the promo code TFTC for $5 off at checkout. Buy it now, freaks. The price of Bitcoin is going up. You need to understand it. This is the best 0-to-1 primer. Back to the show. Back to price. Like, how high do you think we can go this cycle?
Damn. I know.
We're back on stock.
I know.
To flow.
Well, actually, I like David's theory, David Bailey's theory of, that the magnet this time around is going to be the gold parity. So like $600,000 Bitcoin that
you think
like
so.
as we go up and we go, especially once we go above 100, it's like, okay, new territory. Like, what's next? It seems like the obvious target to lock on to. Of course you can say $1 million, which is Samsung Mao's, you know, his theory that's going to happen this time. But I like the 600K one. Because it kind of like whoever is targeting for $1 million is obviously going to have to pass through 600,000 as well. And it's just such an important like psychological thing to be like, holy hell, this 6,000 year old money, we just surpassed it in 15 years or 16 years, something like that. So, but I think lately I've been thinking about, I've always been so hesitant to put price targets on a bull market because I feel that what is more certain, much more certain, and maybe what everything hinges on in a bull market is the length of time that we're talking about. I think the human brain is only capable of so much excitement for so long and so much FOMO and so much adrenaline and everything else that at some point, after a certain while, on average, so there must be like, we need a science, like the bull market science or something where people, you know, like how insurance companies have actuarial tables where they can predict like how many people will die of a given population. Like, we need that same thing where, like, you know, how long till people go crazy, you know, in a bull market? Like, you know, like there must be a point. And you can even maybe look back at the Bitcoin cycles and figure it out. But yeah, so I think that people's brains just get fried at some point. And then they just go nuts and they go in with leverage and they kind of mess it up for themselves. Mm-hmm. And because once you start levering up, then you push the price beyond what makes sense. And then even conservative people get confused and get caught up in that. And then they might take profit off the table and then you actually have the correction and you go into a bear phase again. So anyway, long story short, to just say that, you know, rather than predicting how high it's going to go, I want to say maybe there's, you know, psychological fuel in the tank for like a 2-year, like real bull market. And then the fact that we're starting with such a big push right now in the beginning makes me very, very bullish. Yes. It reminds me of like 2013 where like people thought like, oh damn, like it's going, like we were to like 10 bucks in 2012 and then we went to like 30, which was the previous all time high. And then it just like zoomed past that. And we went to, I believe
1400, right?
Actually, no, we went to 270 in the spring of 2013. And then it declined. It went down to 80 bucks and people thought it was over. And then that, in a span of just a few months, we just went back on the horse. And by the end of the year 2013, we were at 1200 bucks. So like from 10 to 1200, 100x in 2 years time, you know? So the fact that we have so much going on right now, it makes me very bullish. And it makes me think like maybe this could be one of those two-legged, like there's going to be a big fake out and then we just keep steaming forward.
Yeah.
And so all within a span of 2 years, yeah, we could hit a million bucks. Like it's weird to say, but it's almost like only a 10x from here, really.
Yeah,
600,000 is.
Well, I guess maybe a better question is like, how strong do you think the floor that will be developed in this market will be when you factor in ETFs getting in? A lot of people are saying that that money may be stickier than allocators of years past. The ETFs are in. I mean, I've been hearing a lot of rumblings out of the Middle East that people are seriously looking at this, the sovereign wealth funds, the energy producers. I would be pretty confident that we're going to see more nation states enter the fray pretty publicly over the next 2 years.
Who are all going to be, I mean, a bunch of them will have limit orders to buy the dip, right? They're going to have limit orders all the way down. Mm-hmm. So I think those are important factors to think about.
Saylor's not going to be sitting on his island in the public markets alone for too long.
We have
a halving.
At
what point do we just completely detach from cycles, if at all?
No, and I think it's important to really consider the idea of that four-year cycle is going to be gone because the money is really going to, we're going to live in a different world. So far we've been living in a world where you could actually make some money being invested in bonds, government bonds, and that's gone almost entirely, right? I mean, people are even buying bonds with negative interest rates and making money on it. Like that's only a few years ago. So, in a bond crash, because basically the fiat system, because you have monetary tokens that are being debased all the time, obviously there's no incentive to hold cash. And so they kind of developed this proof of stake system, which is like, ooh, now you have yield, which is all that government bond stuff. And certain people have access to the yielding things. And like, and so therefore, and the longer term you are invested in the system, the higher reward you might get. So, you know, buy those long dated bonds, like 100-year bonds or even perpetual bonds. Right. So with the rug being pulled and that whole edifice, it's so hard to predict like what would be the bottom, because that means you're putting on your dollar glasses and you're looking at the Bitcoin price. But like, what if the world starts throwing away their dollar glasses and be like, this doesn't make sense to even think about, you know, like the Argentine peso, like, you know, let's speculate like what would be the bottom of the next cycle for the Bitcoin price. It's like, I don't know. There's going to be so many dips. Like we can speculate about the volatility along the way, like how percentage wise, how big are the corrections going to be? But to have like a really lengthy bottoming period, that assumes you have a stable currency to begin with. And so I'm not saying that the dollar is going into hyperinflation this, you know, the next 2-3 years, but it's really something to keep in mind as a possibility, you know, to just not be like, oh yeah, I'm counting on the next bottom of the bear is going to be 200,000. So once we go above that, I'm going to start selling and, you know, have that hole, and then I'm going to somehow pay my capital gains tax. But still, you know, it's like, no, don't do it. I would say like, yeah, sure, like sell a bit of Bitcoin if you think it'll help you cover your living expenses for the next 2 years. Sure, like, okay, some cash. But don't, that's what I generally would recommend. Don't speculate on these big swings. You might want to speculate a little bit with borrowed money. Like if you can borrow money that is like in a small percentage of your total wealth, your total liquid net worth, and then you have some cash and you can kind of play around with that. If you're a good trader, you can do that, right? But to sell your principal, I don't know. I just think it's a bad idea.
Yeah, Tor, I've been getting laughed at a lot because I truly believe that this time, like the culmination of all the events that we've been describing throughout this whole con, like I find it hard to believe that this time isn't different. Like when you have all this money coming in from the ETFs, it's sticky money. I think the nation states are getting in a big way. The energy sector is getting in a big way. Utility of what you can do with Bitcoin is improving at a rapid pace. It's getting integrated into a bunch of different things, very early stages in these integrations, whether it's Nostr or AI or super collateral for credit agreements, whatever it may be. Like I think, I don't know, the 2024 election, the state of the lack of confidence in these institutions, like I think I find it hard to believe that we have these four-year cycles like we have had in the past.
Well, let's steelman that, right? What is a scenario where there is kind of there's a way for governments to extend the confidence that the general public has in their currencies? I think one scenario is where, on the one hand, our dream, quote-unquote, comes true, or our prediction that central banks start buying Bitcoin. But then what if they turn around and governments start saying, oh, our currency is now backed by Bitcoin, so this is as good as gold, and we guarantee that it's legal, you can pay your taxes with it, it's going to retain its value, blah, blah, blah. So why would you just go into that gray, ugly market where terrorists are also active and like buy your Bitcoin and like deal with all these like shady devices where they can steal your money? Like just buy the euro. It's now backed by clean Bitcoin that is ethically mined. You know, so I think, I need to think this through, but like the thing there is always, I've learned to not... to try and not underestimate the extent to which people can, let's take it in. I've learned to not underestimate how gullible markets can be. Like when Ethereum came out, I was like, this is a fucking scam. Like even the way the auction was set up was like, this is like reverse Dutch auction. And like, there's no way to know the supply beforehand. And like, and look, here we are like, 9 years later, Ethereum is worth like billions of dollars and is so far keeping up with Bitcoin in this market, in this bull market. You know, it's just like, and IQ wise, the average IQ of market participants is going down because like now we're talking mass adoption. So I don't know. I've just had to eat a lot of humble pie. Like I thought back in, and there's gold bulls that have been predicting hyperinflation since the late 70s, the 1970s, that's like 50 years, they'd be like, this thing is going to blow up. And they were right, but it's so hard to like actually nail it. I mean, that said, we're the closest we've ever been. That's for sure.
Yeah.
That's for damn sure. We're the closest we've ever been to a complete collapse. And we also know, thanks Parker, you know, people go bankrupt gradually and then suddenly. So like there is going to be a waterfall moment where we're in free fall.
Yeah.
It's going to be very sudden once it happens.
Yeah. And that's what, like, you mentioned the average IQ of everybody entering the market is falling as mass adoption happens, which I agree. But I believe, like, the average IQ, if you index the average IQ for the amount of money that's coming into the space, like, I think the higher IQ section of the market is accumulating way more Bitcoin right now than retail investors would be.
I mean, yeah, but it's so much as a function of psychology, really, because there's highly, like, you know, Elizabeth Warren is no dummy. She doesn't lack IQ.
Are you sure about that?
Yeah, she has, like, a PhD or whatever. Like, I'm not saying she's genius, but I mean, like, you know, she's not retarded. Sorry, is that, can I say that anymore?
You're fine. Yes,
she's not regarded.
It's coming back.
We're in Austin, like, comedy capital of the world. Yeah.
We need to get those guys down here, by the way. We need to figure out a way. Mothership is two blocks away. They need to start coming into the conference.
We went to see Tom Green two Fridays ago. It was awesome. Yeah, it was awesome. Yeah, Austin is really special.
Yeah.
Man, it's so special to have that. And I think it's actually not a coincidence. And you're totally right. Like, there's all this cross-pollination that I think is bound to happen. And, like, yeah, let's make it happen. But there's so much... It's waiting to happen. Like, I think it's going to not dilute Bitcoin. It's going to enrich it to, like, have all these people from different backgrounds get involved and we can all learn from each other.
Exactly. Not only that, so it's going to be a symbiotic relationship. Because we had the one of the gentlemen from the University of Austin, which is catty corner to us here at the Commons.
You had him on the podcast?
No, he came through and just like wanted to see what was going on here. And that's like a prime example you have.
Yep. Like, I've been to several of their events. Like, just that's another one, another evolution of things that are happening at the forefront, like really like a new university with new people and like a real radical openness to ideas.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's like, you get those guys, you get us, you get the comedians down the road.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's
music scene.
Music scene.
Last time we talked about music, I think.
There's a lot of symbiosis that could happen. Like, empower your new university with Bitcoin, empower your monetization, your comedy with Bitcoin, and then your endorsements of this tool are going to help Bitcoin at the end of the day.
Yeah, it's like the shipping industry 500 years ago. It's like, you know, who wouldn't want to use this, you know, the technology of shipping and navigation to further their, you know, what they're about. And the more radical people in Europe, they would use that. And then that's why we have those different periods of settlement in the US where the most radical people in Europe would just start a little colony or start a trading post using that technology of shipping that wasn't available before. Like, people were able to cross an ocean, but apparently Nick Szabo says this, that the breakthrough in the 1500s was, I forget the exact, if it was the sextant or something like that, but people gained the ability to find their way back because that was the thing. Like, you could go wherever you wanted, but the tools didn't allow you to figure out the same way back.
I didn't realize.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause you imagine, like, just thinking about flying in the air. Mm. When I was in college at Chicago, it was a 3-hour flight on the way there and a 2.5-hour flight on the way back. So you have these different dynamics at play, like in the air with the stream.
Yeah.
And exist in the ocean.
Well, yeah. And so it really helps if you know where you are on the map. Yeah. That's the kind of number one requirement.
Mm. That's another, like, are maps accurate? That's the...
You mean in terms of how large the countries are and stuff? Yeah. I mean, the Peterson projection is the one you got to look at to realize how large Africa is, for example. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how relatively small Russia is and places like that.
It is crazy. That's like a weird form of propaganda, the globe.
Started by a Belgian.
Really?
Yeah, Mercator, yeah.
Why did he construct the map in this way?
I think it kind of makes intuitive sense, right? I mean, you just have the globe and you just kind of like cut it out and then you have all these like if you like a balloon, right? If you cut it out, you put it on a flat piece of paper, then you have all these weird pointy things at the top. And then what are you going to have? A bunch of emptiness? Like, well, you don't want that. So you try and connect them. So you have to like stretch them out. And then you have these nice straight lines. So I think it just appeals to people's sense of aesthetics. And then it was a nice side effect that all of a sudden Europe looked bigger. and so, yeah, it was made in Europe. So it makes sense that they would come up with that, I think.
Yeah. And since you mentioned it, good segue into the event that will be here Wednesday.
Oh yeah.
South by Southwest. The 13th. You, Austin, yeah. Kelly, getting a group of people together here at the Commons to talk about Bitcoin urbanism.
Yeah. Oh man, I'm so excited. Somebody posted this meme of like, I forget, some comedian. It's just like some gif of some comedian who's like at the gates that are closed. He's like, "Let me in." And I was like, I feel exactly the same way, even though I'm hosting it. But I'm so excited. Bitcoin urbanism. I mean, everything is being Bitcoinified, right? And because Bitcoin is changing the world, so we need to kind of look at everything that exists in society. And it's like, do we need to rethink this? Like, what does it mean if we throw Bitcoin in the mix? We always talk about how Bitcoin changes people's time preference. It lowers your time preference, makes you think more long term. And so this event is going to be about, well, what does that mean for building? What does that mean when people build a house, when people start interconnecting houses in a community or commission developments? Is that going to look different? I think it is. And I think a lot of the former kind of glory that we love, things that we love about these older cities that were built when the world was on a gold standard, is going to come back. Mm-hmm. So there's just a lot to be said about how housing has changed over time, and then how a different mindset and a different type of access to capital and different people having access to capital is going to really change how people build a house. And it's very exciting. You know, my granddad, you know, I was like 6 years old, and I remember like seeing the building site and then gradually like seeing the building emerge, and, you know, it's, the house is still there. And it's just, you know, that idea of like building something from the ground up, and then especially imagining that it would stand there for a long time. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in Bruges, which is like one of the best preserved, you know, stone masonry based cities in the world. And so the contrast has been so stark, right? To move to the US and to live in this startup society where, to me, like,
it's all crap.
I mean, to me, the houses look like they're made out of sticks and cardboard, right? It's like, what is
I mean, they literally are in a lot of cases. Yeah, I mean, the doors are literally cardboard in a lot of houses.
Yeah, and also like the buildings, the quality actually has been declining over the last 10 years because of all the cheap money. So there's just so much to be said about how the money changes everything. And so that's why I'm so optimistic as well about how that's going to change. You mm-hmm. know, people have been part of the, you know, I don't like the word, but part of the propaganda that people have been fed is that everyone needs to have a house. Like, I don't think that's true. If you have, what would you rather have? Like, you know, you quote unquote own your own house made of cardboard and sticks, and that's going to fall apart unless you maintain it every 3 years. Or would you rent in a beautiful stone house that's going to, that you get to occupy and that's going to be standing the next 500 years. You know, I'm not saying everybody should pick the latter, but I think we're going to gradually evolve to a society where, you know, most people are going to choose that. They're going to save in Bitcoin and they're going to rent. And then there's going to be a minority of capitalists that just make it their business focus to build and maintain houses, and there'll be landlords. Mm-hmm. And that's totally fine. It's not exploitative. It's win-win. It means that it's division of labor, all that stuff.
Yeah. Mm. And you have, what's Austin's last name again?
Austin Tunnell.
Tunnell.
Yeah, he's in Oklahoma City, and that's where he has his business.
And he's doing really cool things terms of building.
Yeah, I actually visited one of his builds. Yeah, so Austin, I believe about, I'm trying to think, I think it's about close to 10 years ago, made a career switch and started learning from this other guy who's also in Oklahoma. He has a website, I think it's called A Thousand Year House. Mm-hmm. And very masonry focused, because bricks are so amazing. Like, we often talk about how Bitcoin should scale in a modular way. Like, you want layers that are clearly delineated and separated from each other that interlink, so that you have these clear building blocks. And that's exactly what a brick is. Like, this Littlefield building is also built out of bricks, and it makes it so versatile and predictable. And so, yeah, anyway, he started learning like how to build load-bearing masonry walls. Because nowadays, if you look around in the U.S., most of the time, if it's a newer build, you'll see the bricks like that, and they'll all be the same size, one next to another. And that's a pretty good giveaway that it's purely ornamental. Like, it's just a little layer that's not carrying any weight at all. It's just kind of pasted on top of it to make it look nice. But so that building then is just a pastiche of, you know, an actual brick building. And so that's what he builds, is actual brick buildings where the bricks carry the weight of the house. And it's those kind of houses that not only are they so beautiful, and like when you walk into them, you feel the sturdiness, you feel safe. It has like wonderful qualities when it comes to heat exchange and moisture exchange as well. Like, the air is actually qualitatively better in houses like that. But also, if the economy goes through a period of depression and you cannot afford to maintain it. There's nobody there for like 20 years and it's starting to be dilapidated. The house is fine. You can just, you know, go back in there and fix it up and it'll be fine. It'll be beautiful. Or if you want to expand it, you just, you know, you can just make a new doorway or add, you know, and that's what you see in Belgium all the time is these very old houses that have gradually, they're like living things almost. They gradually change and they get, you know, depending on the needs of the occupants, which is a beautiful thing. And you don't have that with, especially concrete, for example. Concrete is very, very difficult to change. It has all kinds of issues when there's Yeah, well, concrete itself is not that bad, but because there's such haste in the economy and builders just want something that that works right now, no matter whether it's going to last for 10 years or 20. So they put steel rebar in there to kind of have tensile strength to like be able to hold up weight and cross a larger area. Well, that steel, once it starts rusting, it literally just breaks down the concrete because it expands. It literally cracks and destroys the concrete over time. So yeah, there's you know, and brick doesn't have that at all. Like that's why it's so inert and beautiful. So anyway, so that's Austin's background and you know the houses that he's built so far are just amazing. And it just baffles me that he's one of the very few in the U.S. that do that. Yeah. It's incredible to me that it's almost like a lost art. And it's not even that much more expensive. You know, it's I think it's like 20-30% more expensive to build a house like that.
It's probably
but for a developer, that's life or death because they compete with all these other cheap builders who provide what the market wants. And most people are not even in the mentality of like living in their house for an extended period of time. They're probably going to flip it. So very interesting to see this.
Yeah. What do you guys plan on covering?
Well, I mean, it'll be just thinking about the parallels between like Bitcoin as a technology that's durable and that has all these beautiful beneficial side effects, and then classical architecture, which similarly has a lot of durable principles that make a whole lot of sense together. And probably one of the things is going to be to clarify that like to enjoy classical architecture doesn't mean you're a Luddite and that you're against, you know, anything that's new or but it's you know what it can mean is just that you appreciate things that really work and they're time tested and proven, which is similar to what Satoshi did with Bitcoin. So that's just one of the aspects that we'll talk about. And then of course there's that exciting speculation of like, well, if we imagine an entire economy already being on the Bitcoin standard, like what kind of projects would you see emerge that we don't see today?
Yeah. Mm. You're not allowed to, if you like classical architecture, you just objectively like good aesthetics and beauty in the world.
Well, I think I'm a little hesitant. It's like people like Roger Scruton and like the British like conservatives, like they kind of like really focus on like, oh, but it's just aesthetically beautiful and then there, but to me then there's always like, yeah, but what about people that say like, oh, but I just love modernism, and to me that's beauty, and then there's kind of like a standoff or a stale. So
function to this as well.
Well, so yeah, the Vitruvian Triad, like that was the famous Roman architect who's the only one that actually had a book that was passed on to us. That's what Leonardo's drawing of the Vitruvian man refers to as Vitruvius. He was that author. So the Vitruvian Triad is those three principles that he keeps going back to, which is utility, durability, firmitas, and then beauty. So those three are the core elements of sustainable good architecture. And so to me that's what you see when you see a beautiful building. If it has the two first ones, if it has utility and if it has real durability, almost always it's going to look very pleasing to the eye, because just like in nature, right? I mean, everything in nature is also built to have that sustainability, durability. And so you see the same shapes, like an arc, for example. It's a beautiful shape, but it's also extremely useful and you know what I mean? Like, those things are very interconnected. So I feel like sometimes conservatives don't really talk about that very much, about the technological side of things. And if you want a building that's durable, it's not enough to just like slap a few solar panels on the roof, right? I mean, it's going to break down in 10 years. Like, that you're going to waste so much more material you're able to save so much more costs if you have a strong foundation. And that means using stone and mortar and wood and things like that usually.
Yeah, the long run costs are significantly less than what you'd have to do if you're...
Yeah, which makes sense. If you have a low time preference society where people save in Bitcoin, who's going to be selling Bitcoin to build a building? It's like, well, if you want to leave a legacy, right? It's like a way to say, I was here.
It was funny because as we're having this conversation, I'm thinking of something I saw Gigi put on Noster yesterday, which is the goal isn't to live forever. It's to build things that last forever.
Yeah. That's exciting to me.
Yeah, me as well. I'm happy you got, because it's sort of, maybe not last minute, but came together sort of serendipitously.
Oh, yeah, very, very serendipitously, yeah.
And Kelly and I have had multiple conversations on this show about Bitcoin urbanism and the way he thinks about it, and being a builder himself and understanding the financial aspect of it. I think it's going to be a really cool conversation night here at the Commons.
Yeah, so we'll have Kelly... We'll have Austin, who's rapidly being orange pilled. He's been reading the Bitcoin Standard and some other things, and I mean, I'm definitely not specialized in Bitcoin urbanism, but I'm very interested in it. And then we recently, there's a German gentleman who's been talking about Bitcoin urbanism as well. I forget his name now. I want to say Udi, but that doesn't sound right. Anyway, he's going to be there too. So like, whoever is listening and is thinking about showing up, it's going to be like, I don't know, it's going to be a very early gathering where maybe I think this is going to turn into a big movement. I would say definitely show up. I want to see who's going to be there, right? It's like, that's why I'm doing this. I want to see who shows up and who we can have conversations with.
Well, I will be there.
Mm. Awesome.
I will be here.
Sweet.
There is here in this building.
Yeah, we actually might do a podcast after, right? Maybe on Friday.
Yeah. Yeah, we need to make that happen.
Yeah,
because it's one of my favorite subjects. So I'm not an expert by any means, just a respecter of durable buildings and good aesthetics. I desperately think need to be brought back to the world.
Maybe we can like from Hoomer to, and then we need to find something that rhymes and that's talking about urbanism. I love the word Hoomer.
What Hoomer built, the boomers destroyed. I don't know. We'll think of something. Speaking of thinking of something, you have anything on top of your mind that you think we should wrap up with?
No, I'm trying to think. Well, I mean, I think it's always a challenge in the bull market to kind of, you know, stay sane. And so maybe now is like, okay, we had this big signal that like, okay, Peter Brandt said it too, like this candle that we saw this last month is massive, and it probably means that this thing is going to go really high. And so I would say it's a good time to like sit together with your wife and like talk about some plans, like, you know, do we have any plans, like, you know, like talk about different price points and just to discuss like, yeah, what do we want to do? And it's totally valid to say we're not going to do anything, we're going to just, you know, ride this whole market, you know, we're going to keep it for the next 5 years, our Bitcoin, and that's our plan. But I think it's helpful to go through it, you know, just to talk it through and be sure you're on the same page, whatever it is that you want to do, because it's going to get crazier from here.
Yeah, my wife and I went to dinner last night and had one of those conversations.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. I mean, because now it's starting to feel real. It's like, oh, it's different, right, from 6 months ago where you're like, oh, it's going to go so high, and... Yeah. It's not real, but now it's like, wow, we actually doubled in a couple months.
I was not expecting the last 2 weeks to play out the way they did.
Yep.
I mean, I was expecting the ETFs to bring a lot of flow and there to be some price movement, but I wasn't expecting it to be that much this quickly.
I gotta say, it feels good to be right.
It really does.
And I mean, to me also, because it's almost like, I think, and I speak for a lot of Bitcoiners, like, we just invest so much of our life and our energy in this.
Yeah,
and
we're
and
in then this to, building.
Right.
It's 9 Bitcoin. Hours a day.
Not, yeah, it's not even 9 to 5. It's like 24/7 Bitcoining. So, yeah, it just feels very validating, I would say, to be like, oh man, like, and in some way, I think it's also like, it's fine to not hurry. You know, the world is going to, I mean, not to be complacent and we want to stay humble, but in many ways, the world is going to come to us. And so if we just kind of like focus on like, okay, what is important to me and what do I want to really excel at? I think the world will find you if you do that in a good way. Because there's so many aspects to the Bitcoin diamond, right?
Mm-hmm.
Facets.
There is. Well, I'm excited for this journey we're about to embark on in the next 2 years. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah.
Sitting down with
totally.
You.
Totally.
Now that we're in Austin, we got to do this more than once every 7 months. We'll do another one hopefully in a few weeks on Bitcoin urbanism. Come down in the comments if you're in Austin during South by Southwest. It's Wednesday the 13th, correct?
Wednesday the 13th. I think it's starting at around 6 p.m. If you follow Bitcoin Commons on Twitter, you'll see more announcements. It's now listed as like a meetup event. So it's I think there is limited admission, but it is free.
Yes. So go check out the page. Join us. We'll see you guys. Peace and love.